Justin.
Hello, Brad.
You know, Justin, when I first started doing machine learning, and specifically neural networks, there really was not a lot of tooling. And we had to bake everything ourselves, from how do we train the models through to where do we store them, where do we deploy them. And over the years, there's been like a lot of tooling that's developed, and like the whole industry is kind of broken apart. There's now, you know, a lot of people, they'll have a research team that first produces, say, a Jupyter notebook, and then they'll hand that off to an ops team. And like when I started, it was all just mixed together. You just like, I just, you know, wrote my Python code. I never even used a notebook. I'm just wondering, you know, we haven't had an episode talking about how that has evolved, how that has gone from just like ad hoc through to like ML ops being like a discipline and like a job title that different people have. Like, what do you think about this whole ML ops phenomenon, Justin?
Or if it should even be a job title. I think that there are a lot of, different opinions in this space. And I think that initially, you know, there have been great tools, you know, MLflow, Kubeflow, there's been good tooling there. And I think that today we're in a new world where we have these large language models and there is a prolification of different tools and different options. There's an enormous amount of noise in the market. There's a lot of signal. There's a lot of really cool demos that are being, you know, shown on Twitter and Reddit and YouTube. And sometimes it can be challenging to kind of take those really cool things and put them into actual production applications where they provide value with a decent ROI. And we have the incredible pleasure today of having Andy on our show. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm a big fan of the show, so delighted to be here.
That's great. Well, before we get started, Andy, why don't you maybe just spend 30 seconds just sharing about who you are and what you do?
Yep. So I am head of ML Ops, machine learning operations at NatWest Group, so one of the UK's biggest banks. I'm also the author of a book, Machine Learning Engineering with Python, published by PACT, which is all about ML engineering, ML ops. And basically, I've spent the last few years going through this journey that Brad has spoken about and really trying to build out what it means to have best practice in taking cool ideas and POCs and building production-grade applications that can scale for large enterprises. And that's basically what I do every day and what I think about and what I'm passionate about.
So, Andy, question. How do you manage all the different signals in the space, all the noise with the prolification of MLOps tools? How do you sit down and basically pick what you need? Where do you even get started with that?
It's a brilliant question. And I think the point you mentioned about the signal to noise ratio really leads to what I call analysis paralysis often. So there's just so many tools out there that you can see them all on a page and sort of think, right, which one do I pick? Where do I start? But I often actually say tooling is not where to start. What's more important is actually around process, and it's around how you think about what you need to do. And Brad was alluding to this, right? So before we had the term MLOps, you would just do it. You would just build the solution and you would use software engineering practices. It would just be the case that you're now using some machine learning. And then we kind of went away from that a bit and it became more and more about the models, and then it became more and more about the cool tools. And then it's kind of came back to this point where I think MLOps now is really, there's a lot of tooling available, but to me, it's really about those set of practices and techniques and the way of thinking about this. So it's less about picking, you know, you mentioned Kubeflow or SageMaker or Vertex. It's less about that, because if you know the process you want to do, if you know the steps, if you know the techniques to take POC, Python codes, wrap it up, build it, harden it, orchestrate it, deploy it, you'll be able to do that in any tool. So I kind of almost say step back from the tools, because that is a lot of noise. There's a lot of good tools, there's a lot of bad tools, but it just generates a lot of noise. The real signal is when you follow people who know what they're talking about in the space. So there's tons of great people on LinkedIn I follow. There's tons of great people who write on Medium, etc. But look for the people who are talking about that process and who really just talk about good software engineering practices being applied to machine learning workloads. And I think then you'll find actually You know, you can you just naturally cut through the noise and you start seeing, oh, it's actually about how you do things. It's not what you use to do them. That's sort of a secondary consideration. So that's the first thing I would say. It's most important.
Okay. I wanna expand on that. So what is the process? Like, I know there's a lot there, but just like, could you give us a high level summary of what you see as a good process for ML ops?
So in my book, I talk about this in a lot of depth. So I think any machine learning project roughly has a set of stages that you can sort of group into four. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, depending how you're kind of feeling or how you want to shape it. But ultimately, there's an initial step where you do discovery. So this is where the sort of data scientists traditionally are really important, spend a lot of time. So they'll talk to the business, they'll understand the problem space. They'll try and map out, you know, how does that start becoming a data problem? So you either want to find fraud in transaction data, or you want to produce a recommendation for a certain product. So you discover that kind of area, that domain, and understand it as much as possible. So that's sort of the discovery phase. I then think there's an experimentation or proof of concept or play phase, I call it in the book. And that's where you say, right, okay, I get the shape of the problem, but now I'm going to start hacking. And you can hack at this point. I think that's absolutely fine. So the data scientists, for example, will start, you know, munging data, wrangling some data, putting it into an sklearn pipeline or a PyTorch model. They'll start sort of doing their first experiments. They'll start tracking those experiments. And they'll start just trying to get a feel for, right, is this problem solvable in principle? Can this even be done? And you start coming up with those plots that say, right, I can get this accuracy, I can get this precision, I can get this sort of understanding using the tools at my disposal in the data science space. You then move on to what I call the develop phase. So this is when software engineering best practice starts really coming into its own. So you start thinking, right, how do I build what I've came up with in those previous phases into pipelines, into sequential steps of processes that I can run and orchestrate in a kind of repeatable process, a repeatable way that will form the backbone of my eventual product. So you start thinking about, you know, do I use a tool like Airflow to orchestrate? Do I use sklearn pipelines, Spark pipelines? Do I use SageMaker? Some of the other tools I mentioned, but how do I basically start creating something that builds up these atomic steps of processing, feature engineering, modeling, inference, training, etc.? I start building out the system that way. And that's where develop comes in. So that's all your CI/CD and all of these unit testing, etc. And then you get to the final stage, which is deploy. And that's where you really have to think, what is the architecture of the system? What is the kind of final hardware or infrastructure I want to actually serve the solution on? And how am I going to interface that with upstream and downstream solutions? So how do I, you know, give the inference output into a downstream system to consume? Is it a Kafka topic? Is it a REST API and things like that? So there's kind of that to me is those, that's very high level, and we can drill down into that, and we can drill down about how that changes for large language models in some places. But you kind of, that's the broad buckets of the kind of steps. And then the final bit that kind of is lumped together at the end, but is maybe its own phase, is the post-deployment operational phase. So this is where you're doing more monitoring, you're doing more maintenance, you're thinking about patches and upgrades of the solution. You're kind of into that BAU or running of the tool rather than just the build. And once you do that, that's kind of, that's the end-to-end life cycle in a nutshell.
All right. So if I'm going to echo back here. So the first step was, it's sort of just trying to understand the problem. And like, that's where someone's interacting with the business team and just turning it into a data problem. Then the second step is they come up with like an initial model, or they're looking actually hands-on at the data, experimenting. They're not trying to write good code at that point. They're just trying to write something that works. If you've ever exported some Jupyter code and then actually tried to productionize it, you basically start from scratch. It's like, it's just inspiration for the final solution, but it's not there. But that, okay. And then step three, you're saying, someone then is just like, okay, how do we engineer this in like a live system that accomplishes the same thing that that data scientist just accomplished with their, you know, Jupyter notebook and their quick and dirty whatever.
Yep.
And then the fourth step was then you connect it into the consumer with whoever's requires the outputs of the model. And then fifth step was just like monitoring and
yep.
measuring accuracy, making sure that there's not drift or yep. stuff like that. Did I interpret your breakdown
exactly.
correctly?
Exactly right. The one thing I would pick up on that you mentioned was kind of, and I sort of set up like this, data scientist does the beginning and then an engineer comes in. The North Star that I always aim for is that actually a cross-functional team does everything. And the reason I think that's important is because there used to be this world, you know, of developer does development, operations does ops, and that's where DevOps was born because they said, no, let's do it all together. Let's close the loop. And let's get rid of that kind of wall we kick things over. MLOps to me is just the same. It's the same spirit. It's the same sort of culture you want to foster. So ideally, and it doesn't always work in practice, depending on, you know, the historical context of the organization, the size of the teams, all of these things. These can be factors. But fundamentally, I think the ideal case is where you build it, you run it, you own it. And that just gives kind of the people who have the best knowledge about the domain and the problem and then the solution, they kind of control all of those steps. And I just think that ultimately is the best place to be. And there are challenges with that, but I think that's kind of where you want to get to if it's true MLOps or DevOps.
So Andy, you just described a process that I think, you know, has been used time and time again, especially in your more traditional machine learning. And you even mentioned, you know, a famous traditional machine learning library, you know, PyTorch. And today, what we're seeing a lot of is we're seeing a lot of large language model stuff. And that's pretty much what we're calling APIs, you know, and maybe we bring large language model in-house, but either way, we're still kind of calling APIs there. How does that process differ, knowing that that initial development phase can actually be done a lot faster today than it used to be done?
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I think the sort of the proof of concept stage is happening really rapidly. And that's a combination of things. So one is the offloading of the ML component to an API, like you mentioned, Justin. The other, I think, is because the models we're using are just so capable. So they're just so powerful. You know, you can prompt GPT-4 and say, write me a Python script that does this analysis that would previously take me a few weeks to bang my head about, but it just sort of does it because it's seen so many examples before. And I think that's meaning that those initial stages are going much more rapidly, like you said. I think, however, we're then reaching a point where there's a bit more of a chasm between doing that POC and actually getting something into production. And that's what we're sort of working through as an industry, because I'm basically seeing that, you know, when I started in MLOps, there was a statistic going around saying that 80% of machine learning projects failed to make it to production. I like to think we kind of switched that round and we got kind of the other way, 80% or 90% or 95% were going to production or could go to production. I think we've kind of went backwards again, and that's just because we're so good at building POCs, but then how do you kind of go and build through to production? And I think the things that are different to really drill down in your question are things like, okay, I have less of a focus now on experimenting with the core model. I might still do fine tuning. I might still build adapters, and I want to track all of those experiments like I would normally. But I might just want to use the vanilla API. But now I'm kind of thinking about prompting. And that's very different, because before I would have a model with a very clearly prescribed, you know, input schema of features normally. Yes, in natural language processing, it was different, but even then I would often massage it into bag of words and lemmatize it. I would kind of create these numbers that would be very standardized in shape. Now the input is just pure natural language. So the kind of space of possible inputs is huge. So what we're now kind of seeing, or I'm seeing a lot of, is a lot of thinking around how do you provide some structure on that to try and control what's going to happen. So you can, you know, provide input forms for people, or you can try and massage what's coming in as natural language into certain prompt patterns. There's a lot of great papers about prompt patterns and standardization of prompts, sort of the shapes of the prompts. So thinking about things like that is very different. And then tracking those prompts, what works, what doesn't, trying to map that to the outputs you get. And then on the output side, there's the evaluation and monitoring question, which I think is really difficult for LLMs just now. There's a lot of great stuff in the POC phase or in benchmarks where we can say, on this benchmark, here's the performance, here's the Hugging Face leaderboard. But me in a kind of operational sense in a business, I don't care too much about that often. I kind of, you know, I'm not gonna switch out all my production solutions to the latest model that topped the Hugging Face leaderboard because it topped that leaderboard. I'm kind of going to be more concerned about metrics specific to the problem I want to solve. And I think we have to do a lot of work to come up with those metrics because it's not just, you know, precision recall, etc. There's a lot more things I have to think about. And there's a lot of good thinking in that, but I think it takes a lot more work to come up with that. And that then feeds into things like the monitoring side of it. How do I build a process where I'm doing a combination of using LLMs as automated evaluators, using humans as SMEs? How do I link the two? Can I get ground truth data? Does that even make sense for my problem? Can I develop proxy metrics? I think about that a lot. So as an example, if I'm building a chatbot, I maybe can't measure ground truth in that, but I can measure, you know, sentiment of the conversation. I can measure containment rates. So how long can I keep the person engaged with the bot? I can, you know, measure sort of even cuss words or whatever if it gets really out of hand. But, you know, I can start thinking about proxy metrics. So those are just some of the challenges where I think it becomes a bit different. So it's definitely of the same spirit as classic MLOps, but there are important differences, I think.
So you mentioned that there's this chasm where we're developing a POC and then you got to productize it or you got to put it in. I'm curious to learn, in that POC stage, how many different ways of doing things do we try out in that phase? Do we try out a minimum of 2-3 of them just to get a good feeling of what we're doing? Or do we say, hey, you know what? I have a gut feeling that this works. Let's try it out. And if it meets this certain benchmark or this certain criteria, then we're good to go. We could continue on our work.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think in traditional machine learning, I would kind of expect a lot of iteration around the avenue because it's very easy to do. You know, there's AutoML libraries. There's, you know, you can just hard code your own loops, but you could very easily, because it was relatively small data, not very sophisticated models at times, you could try lots of things, throw lots of things at it and just see which one performed best. I think the important thing though is really thinking early on, even though you're doing that discovery phase, what are the important constraints I'll have as I go later in the process? So if I'm building this model and I'm doing certain types of evaluation, am I going to have that sort of data to do monitoring with later? Or is that actually, no, that's a one-off piece of data I'll never see again? Or, you know, my model only works if I have 5 years of training data, but I can't wait another 5 years for training data. So it's just little things like that, and sort of, am I going to need sliding windows to build up data? Little things like that. So I think, to your point, I think before, where it was lighter weight models, smaller data sets, throw lots of stuff at it. But when we then moved into the sort of deep learning world, that was a bit harder to do. There was a bit more kind of thought had to go into it. But I would still always be pushing sort of my teams and the projects I was part of for, what's the minimum viable model? What's the simplest sort of way to go after this? And sometimes it was a linear regression. It was not the sexiest, coolest thing. It was like, you know, but it would work, and you know, it would be robust. It would be very maintainable. It would be easy to debug. And I would be always looking for, you know, what's that fallback? And then we'd maybe try a more sophisticated approach. And sure, there's uplift, but try and consider the trade-offs. So I'd say a couple of approaches. Now what we're seeing as the default position, I would argue, is everyone just goes for GPT-4. Right, everyone's just getting that API and smashing it, or they're pick your favorite LLM, doesn't have to be GPT-4, but they're just absolutely hitting it, and they're spending more time on the prompt engineering side. You know, how can I frame this as an in-context learning problem or a one-shot classification problem or whatever? And I think that's an interesting dynamic that we've yet to see play out, is what does that really mean for, you know, how confident we are about going into production later? Because there's just such an assumption that model is going to be X performant. I'm spending more time on how do I prompt that and probe it to do the right thing? So I think that's a very interesting change, is I'm seeing lots of, you know, here's prompt template one we tried and prompt template two we tried, but it's the same fundamental model. Whereas before it'd be quite different algorithmic approaches. So I'm kind of interested in that problem about what does that mean fundamentally for performance at the end of the day?
It seems like in the switch from regular old school deep learning, where, you know, most of the stuff was supervised, you know, and you get a ground truth, you train a model, blah, 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 it's predictable. And in towards LLMs, where it's kind of mostly done at inference time, I feel like people just kind of lost the basics. Like there's like the basics of just like measure your accuracy, do like iterative improvement, A/B test rather than doing 10 changes at once. Like is that something you're observing, where it's just like we're coming back around and be like, oh, all that old AI stuff actually is still relevant and does still matter with this new way of doing LLM?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, an excellent observation. I think what I'm seeing is, in my sort of data science colleagues and the people who have expertise in the areas you're talking about, Brad, they are applying that thinking there. And it's quite impressive to see. I've been really impressed with the work, you know, we've done at NatWest, and I know about in my wider sort of peer group, where you see people applying the same skills they had before, thinking about all the points you've mentioned. You know, how do I build a good experiment? How do I really test from multiple angles? How do I build out that kind of real picture of performance? I think they are applying that, but it's very much a case of, you know, changing, like you said, the sort of experiments I feed into this model. I think the other side of it, though, that's very difficult to manage is because this stuff is so much more democratized, a lot of people who play with it don't have those skills. So you're kind of, I think what you're seeing now is like, it's so easy for people who are extremely talented software engineers, or even not that, you know, anyone can pick up and go into ChatGPT or Claude, etc. I think because you're seeing that, there's people who are coming at it from they don't have that viewpoint, and they go, I got it to do this very cool thing, so I'm just going to assume it's always going to do this cool thing robustly and scalably and repeatably, and then that can be where problems arise. So I think I'm seeing it less in terms of the core data science professionals and the ML engineers, etc., but maybe in that wider cadre of people, just because they've not been exposed to it before, and they don't think it's important because they've maybe not heard about it, and that's no failure of theirs. It's just kind of the nature of the challenge, I think.
Yeah, you're just like some software developer, like you have a strong software engineering background. Like I find a lot of the business I'm getting right now on the prompt engineering side is like someone got a prompt working once, and they're like, wow, look at this. And like, usually the prompt is like way too complex, and they'll come to me and they'll be like, look at this prompt, it works quite well, but it doesn't work in like this case, in this case, in this case, in this case, in this case. And then like, usually the first thing is I think about is just like, do you have any automated way to measure whether the prompt works? Almost always the answer is no. And like the second one is like, how many other variations of this prompt did you try? The answer is almost like, we haven't tried any variations. It's like, we got the one working and we're happy with that. You know, it's like, I think you're right, is that it's the background of people, like the programmers and engineers and even business people and marketers who, you know, they try it with ChatGPT once and they're like, oh, look at this amazing thing. And, you know, and then they're just not thinking about whether that actually scales or reproduces.
Yeah. And some of them will bring that, and sometimes it's just a language thing. Some of them will bring that knowledge of, you know, regression testing, unit testing, end-to-end testing, etc. They'll bring that and sort of intuitively understand that challenge, and you can sort of bridge that gap. But sometimes, like you say, if you don't have that background, you might not be thinking too much about it. And I think that point in time that you've mentioned is really important, because I'm really interested in the sort of the envelope of stability, I sort of think of it, for these models. You know, we've seen things recently or before where some of the most popular LLMs like GPT-4, etc., you know, went berserk, as they said on X, and it just started spouting all sorts of crap, basically. And that's because OpenAI were doing stuff under the hood, as they are going to do, to try and improve it. But, you know, the kind of even if they were doing something far more subtle than that, like you've mentioned, if your prompt is sort of, I got this prompt working on a Tuesday last month and it was raining, you know, it's just all these weird conditions that sort of made this work. I'm interested in the stability of that through time and how do you measure that and start thinking about, you know, could you build up a library or of a standard set of test prompts and expected responses and start building sort of regression suites where you say, you know, I'm expecting this behavior. Has that behavior drifted as a sort of prompt response pair or sets of patterns?
Oh, this is a very cool idea. Let's expand on that.
So I read this somewhere and I can't remember where. If someone remembers, if it was your idea, please reach out and claim it back. But this sort of idea, I think of, you know, you've got the prompt and you've got the response you get, and then you could sort of view them as a tuple and take them together and view them as one almost feature vector. And then how does that drift through time? And I think that's just a sort of, you don't really need to do that if you own the model. I think you could do it, but if you're maybe, it's a good regression test if you're tweaking the model or building adapters or fine tuning. But if you're kind of, you don't own the model and you just want a temperature check of, is this still behaving the same way it was before? I think it's good to sort of have that. Here's the set of expected behavior. It's just like unit tests, right? It's what we always do. You put in an input, you put in an output. Here you're just saying, right, I've got this way of treating it. Input, output. What does that look like as an embedding vector or whatever? And how does that change through time? And I just constantly temperature check it. And if it's fine, it's fine. And if something's different, I should pick it up.
So a process there would be just like having some code that runs 100 prompts. Like we just store what the output is and then later run the same 100 prompts again. And like, you know, maybe with a temperature of zero or something and just see like, did it change? I know that in my code, I do include unit tests that will route through ChatGPT. So it's like, they're not quite as like, I'm checking the behavior is the same over time, but it's just like, I'm checking like, does this prompt produce the result that needs to go into this hard-coded logic over here? But I think what you're describing is actually a pretty, taking it a step further could be a much more useful thing to do.
Yeah, and then there's kind of, I think it relates to metrics like self-check GPT. There was this paper that said what you could do is take a prompt and perturb the prompt and ask the LLM the different versions of this question, essentially. And if you saw that the answer was very similar every time, you basically had a handle on how robust the LLM's responses would be about this topic. So you can anthropomorphize it and say, does the LLM understand this concept? I don't like doing that too much, but you're basically testing, you know, if I take this question and I change it slightly 10 different ways and I get a response back that's quite similar in, say, embedding space, that probably tells me that the LLM's given quite robust answers and robust, consistent behavior around this topic. And I think you can build regression suites around that, you know, because if you start seeing that actually, I changed this prompt not too much. I switched around some words, or I, you know, just reordered something or changed basically how it's phrased, and I got a completely different answer. Then I know there's maybe some instability there, and that's just something to watch or something I'd like to pick up on in monitoring. So thinking about these things, and it's just the whole surface of possibilities has opened right up, which I think is a really interesting challenge for someone like me interested in the ops question. But it is not a solved problem, but there's lots of things you can do like that, I think.
So I guess, you know, you talk a lot about these research papers, and this is pretty cutting edge stuff, like understanding how to test, you know, these different prompts. I'm curious to learn, when we're doing this, how do we pick the best way of doing it, knowing full well that maybe next week there's an even better way of doing it? You know, do we kind of use tooling immediately, or, you know, do we do something like Brad just did, where we kind of, you know, build out our own tooling, or we get together as an engineering team and we say, you know what, this is the best way we're going to be able to do this as a team, and we just get it done internally?
Great question. And I think this applies, the way I would approach this applies in any machine learning or AI problem. I always try and push the bounds of what you have in terms of open source and what's lying around on your bench right now, on your tool bench. Because if you go out to the market, say, and you try to buy a product, if you haven't done your own kind of experimentation, you're not a very informed buyer. And you can very easily get caught up in, you know, someone has a nice slide deck and they say we can solve everything. And I've had that pitch a few times, you know, we are the MLOps platform for everything. I think it's important you sort of, like you were saying, you try it yourself and find out where that sort of challenge comes up, and you say, right, here's the real pain point. If someone solved this specific challenge, for example, I remember working years ago before MLflow kind of took off a lot, and I think you mentioned a similar example, Brad. We were sort of building our own metadata tracking and experiment management. We were just basically having a JSON with the metadata for the experiments we were constantly updating. And we knew that was a pain point, but because we had tried it and built our own thing. So when you see something like MLflow or Comet or whatever tool, you say, oh, that's actually solving that specific problem. So now I'm an informed buyer and I can use it. So I think the same applies here in terms of,
you almost
of like,
need to have the problem first,
yes,
to know that the tool is actually useful.
Exactly. No, I think that's exactly it. It's like if you kind of want to build power tools, you probably need a problem to solve with them first. You don't just go out and say, I want to buy a power tool. You say, like, I have a fence to build, I have shelves to put off or something. A poor analogy, but you get the idea. In terms of the cutting edge research thing, I think that's a real challenge just now. And that comes back to the signal to noise problem we mentioned. So it's really hard to keep up. It's like drinking from a fire hose or a fire hydrant every single day. I'm really struggling to keep up. And what I say to people is, let's not try and keep up. Let's find what works for the problem we're solving, and let's use that and kind of use it in anger and really kick the tires with it. And if that kind of that prompts perturbation thing or some other metric validation I've found in a package or something I've came up with in my team, if that works, I don't really care that there's a new paper in archive, because it works. And it's going to keep working, and I understand it. I can document it. And then eventually, if there's a really strong case to be made that we should upgrade it or change it, then let's consider that. But let's not kind of chase the latest and greatest thing, because then we'd never get anything done. We'd never ship. And that would be the thing that would absolutely break my heart, because that's what I'm all about, is like, let's get this shipped. So I'd rather have, you know, the minimum viable working solution rather than the latest, greatest techniques and tools.
Right. So basically what you're saying is let's not, once again, this is what you said originally, right? Let's ignore the tooling. Let's focus on the problem at hand. Let's try to understand the problem we're trying to solve internally with our team. Let's try to build data solution internally with our team, right? Let's even ignore the hype. Let's use what we have on our tool bench right now. And then maybe, you know, 6 months, a year down the line, if there is something that's significantly more valuable, then we could kind of reassess where we're at. You also mentioned, you know, a little earlier on this podcast that now we kind of default to GPT-4. And that's kind of like the default that we have. And I'm curious to learn, is that the best approach? Because I know that for a lot of problems I'm solving today, sometimes gradient boosting is a better solution, you know. Sometimes just like a very basic binary model is going to work a lot better, you know, than GPT-4. So how do you kind of make that decision whether to go to GPT-4 by default immediately and jump on that, you know, hype wagon versus maybe taking a step back and kind of saying, maybe there is a better, you know, approach to this problem?
Yeah, it goes to that point we mentioned about, you know, knowledge of people and the sort of education. I don't mean education in terms of your degree or whatever. I mean education in terms of solving these problems or having it communicated to you about how we solve these problems. If people have that sort of experience, that gut instinct, that actually a support vector machine might work better here. And I've seen, you know, that and what you mentioned before, XGBoost, LightGBM, etc. These things are... they're tried, they're tested, they work. If we have the knowledge and awareness to try those approaches, then we might find that actually they perform better. I see nothing wrong with sort of, you know, these powerful large language models are sitting on the shelf. I've already hooked them up to hit them with some stuff. I'll do that and get a little POC working. But it is incumbent on us to think, as we move towards production, what am I actually trying to optimize? And I'm not trying to optimize, you know, number of hits to a random expensive API because it looks good on a sales pitch or on a public announcement. We use GPT-4 to do blah, blah, blah. What's more important is actually, did we solve the problem? Did we do it at cost or cost effectively? And did we do it efficiently? And questions like that. And sometimes that means you're forced down a route of, can I distill down to a smaller model or can I just approach the problem completely as a vanilla sort of ML question from before? So I think, yeah, it's such an important point, and it's one I'm constantly hammering home. If it ain't broke, don't fix it sort of thing. And simple is often the best approach if it works.
Do you find yourself exploring different LLMs, or have you kind of like picked one and this is the one you're going with? Right now, there are a few LLMs out there, and like you say, you know, new ones are appearing every day. New ones are appearing on the Hugging Face leaderboard every day. Some of them are maybe a little bit trained on the training data set to get up there on the leaderboard, which is okay for them. But how do you kind of pick and choose your large language models?
An approach that I've seen that I really like is there was a great article by the team from Quantum Black, the AI arm by McKinsey. And they spoke about how they built their own knowledge assistant. So basically a RAG system, but a bit more sophisticated than that. And in that, they've got this online on the MLOps community page. You can kind of find it if you Google around. And they talk about an LLM gateway. And in that, they speak about how, you know, they should have a router, basically, where if you have a need for a different LLM, the user or the system can specify that. Because they might have it for a variety of reasons. They might want something that has, you know, a bit less guardrails, a bit more kind of earthy language like Grok, or they might want something that is kind of telling people that it's sentient like Claude, or, you know, they might just have a different requirement, whatever that is, and they want to try different LLMs. The main things for me are, you know, what class is it roughly? So you get the kind of the GPT-4 class models, as I would call them, so the real kind of leaders, and that includes both the vendor specified ones and open source. And then you get the ones, the GPT-3.5 turbos and the kind of the models like that. So you have those kind of performance stratifications. And then you think about, like I just mentioned, do I want to go a vendor or do I want to do an open source model and host it myself? And you might want to do that for a variety of reasons. So you might just want more auditability. So I work in a heavily regulated industry. It might be far easier for me in some cases to own the full end-to-end stack for, you know, explainability reasons, bias reasons, if I want to do very robust testing on multiple different failure modes, then it might be easier for me to do that. And then there's kind of those sort of considerations. So I think it's important to keep your options open and build a sort of portfolio, sort of hedge your bets. As soon as you're ever dependent on one provider, you've built a single point of failure, and that's not a redundant system. And you should think about kind of how you're setting this up as a system as well. James Clear, who wrote the book Atomic Habits, says you do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. And that, to me, perfectly encapsulates what MLOps is about. It's sort of building those robust systems, operational systems, technical systems, so that even when things go wrong, you've got redundancy and you can
sort of still pick up and keep going. So
I think, yeah, it's important to have
here,
a sort of portfolio approach and just see what works for the problem.
We really shouldn't pick one model. And in a sense, just like with software engineering, we want to decouple our software components. You're saying we need to decouple ourselves from any specific model. So if we need to switch from one to the other, it's super easy. I mean, they're standardized, right? They take text as input and they produce text as output. You couldn't imagine something easier to encapsulate and switch out.
Yep. I know, absolutely. And I think building that redundancy as much as you can is super important. And you can build that redundancy in other ways as well. You know, if you could fall back to a simpler solution, build that in as well to your system. So if it's a chatbot, you've probably already got chatbots in place that use more classic conversational interfaces. Can you default to that if things go wildly wrong in the LLM provider space? So there's lots of ways to decouple, but that is the key word, is decoupling and not building single points of failure. So modularization separation of concerns, all of these good software engineering practices are really important to bring into play here.
I guess, Andy, I know that we're close to time over here. I have one final question for you. We know that, you know, these inputs are standard. They're all text-based inputs for these large language models, or at least the vast majority of them. However, one input to one model may yield very different outputs than the same input to a different model. And I'm curious to learn, you know, even if we are using some sort of LLM gateway, how do we kind of, you know, prepare for that? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think treat it the same way you would any sort of data science experiment, like we were talking about before. So all you're doing here is testing the efficacy of different modeling approaches, which is a problem we've always done. It's just before it was, you know, here's my XGBoost, or here's my LightGBM, or here's my logistic regression, whatever the problem was before. Here you're just saying, try these different off-the-shelf models. And then those challenges we mentioned before about what is good, what evaluation metrics do I use? But as long as you do that and you kind of build the right experiments, you can start understanding, you know, what are the pros and cons of these different models for my problem. And by having that gateway approach, you can do that far more easily, because you can switch them. To Brad's point, you can just decouple that choice and just make it a sort of switch, and you can run your experiment suite and say, you know, right, try OpenAI's models, and then I'm going to try Anthropic's models, and then I'm going to try AWS's Titan models, or I'm going to try these models. And I think that's the key thing, is start building up that experimental muscle and doing all of the things we did before around experiment metadata management. We do that with MLflow and all these tools for classic machine learning. You're now just doing that, but the experiments are, here's the prompt, what's the response, and does that answer my question? Does it have relevancy? What's the precision of recall, of retrieval, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same, but it's different at the same time. And you just need to appreciate that nuance, but still treat it as an experiment to be done.
I don't know about you, Brad, but this has been one of the most interesting podcast episodes, I think, that we've recorded. Andy, thank you so much. Before we, you know, end this show, how can people reach out to you? And do you mind just sharing a little bit more about that book you wrote?
Yeah, the best place is LinkedIn. So just, you'll find me, Andy McMahon, on LinkedIn. I'm also on X at Electric Ouija. We'll probably put that in the show notes. But yeah, the book I wrote, so Machine Learning Engineering with Python, the second edition came out late last year. And in that, I massively updated everything. So it covers everything from how should you set up your ML ops or ML engineering team, through to really hands-on, how do you build example solutions from the ground up? So here's a little POC, all the way through to how you deploy, scale, monitor, all of the things we've been discussing. I basically take the reader through in a very hands-on way how to do that and how I think about that. And I include a sort of section in the latest edition on LLM ops and things like prompt ops and prompt management. Just to give a little bit of a flavor of that problem. But it's a very hands-on book, very technically kind of involved, and it's all about giving people all of the knowledge I wish I had when I started out. I basically tried to condense into this book for people to pick up off the shelf. So it's good if you're in the space and sort of getting started, but also if you're a practitioner, I think it will help you see kind of how I approach some of these problems as well.
I love it. Thank you so much, Andy. And thank you for our listeners. Please consider, you know, subscribing to this show. Your listens is what motivates us. And also, please feel free to link up with Brad, who is an amazing machine learning engineer. He builds fantastic machine learning applications of great quality. And I guess that's pretty much it for the show.